I can very clearly remember the first time I ever heard a sermon on the wretched man of Romans 7. I was a teenager at the time. And even before the pastor had finished reading the scripture for his message, I noticed that heads were nodding all over the congregation in empathy with this man who cannot do as he will. And the woman who was sitting in front of me said, "Yes, that's right, that's me." And the preacher used this sympathetic vibration between the text and the congregation to show the relevance of Romans 7 to the Christian life. And the last time I heard a sermon on this passage, which was just a few weeks ago, again, the same reaction. It struck me that it might be hazardous to rely too heavily on emotional empathy as a tool of interpretation, not prejudging whether that interpretation is correct or not. To give an easier example, Romans 2:8 refers to those who are selfishly ambitious and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness. And I may read this, and I may blush because I might recognize something of myself in that, but my reaction does not prove that that text refers to the Christian. And in fact, the context shows very clearly that it is, first of all, a description of the lost. So we're going to need to keep this hermeneutical concern in mind as we approach the emotionally gripping Romans chapter 7. I'd like to give a few words on the history of the interpretation of this passage before we get into our own study. From the days of the church fathers until now, the wretched man of Romans 7 has been placed in either of two categories. And you may want to refer to your handout, the shorter handout. Two general categories first of all, this may be the unregenerate man, or it may be the regenerate man, regenerate viewpoint. The exceptions to this rule, notably found in C.K. Barrett, usually affirm that both views could be true in different ways, but at the same time. But within these two main camps, there are subdivisions, and they're mentioned down in that section which says variations. And this time, these subdivisions are generally along the lines of whether Paul was speaking of himself or of people in general. And you can take a look at the different viewpoints that are listed there. These are the main ones anyway. Under the unregenerate view, the view that this is autobiographical, this is Paul before he became a Christian. Secondly, that this is Paul's experience but now viewed from Christian hindsight. Third, that this is an average Jew as viewed from his own perspective. Fourthly, the viewpoint that we'll be promoting, that this is an average Jew as analyzed by Paul as a Christian. And fifthly, that this is an average Jew or Gentile moralist. These overlap quite a bit. Under the regenerate viewpoint, there is the autobiographical view that this is Paul in his own Christian life. Secondly, that this is Paul speaking for all Christians. Third, that this is the average Christian trying to serve Christ legalistically but failing. Fourth, that this is the average new or carnal believer. Or fifthly, that this is the mature believer who comes to see the depth of his own sinfulness, that is, as he's maturing and understanding God's holiness and sin a little bit better. It's worth noting that Augustine originally held to the unregenerate viewpoint, and while he was at Carthage, he used Romans 7 to counter the Pelagians, who taught a natural human tendency toward the good. But Augustine later changed his mind through reading the commentaries of Cyprian and Ambrose on Romans, deciding that the wretched man is best taken to be Paul's own struggle as a Christian. He tells a story in his book called The Retractions, which was written late in his life to correct things that offended him about his earlier writings. Augustine's experience may serve as a warning to those who might try to oversimplify the interpretation of Romans 7. Franz Leinhardt, looking back over the history of the discussion, reckoned that the battle over Romans 7 had always been waged between the exegetes, who he said went with a view of the unregenerate man, and the dogmaticians that he linked with the regenerate viewpoint. Although his remark was a bit self-serving, he was an exegete going for the unregenerate viewpoint, it does open the door for our own recommendation. I'd like to suggest that the interpreter's primary consideration be for the place of Romans 7, 14 to 25 within the argument of Romans 5 through 8. And even though we will need to relate our findings to a doctrine of depravity, we'll be doing so mainly in conjunction with Paul's own description of the depraved in Romans 2 through 3. In this paper, we will argue that Paul is describing life in general under Judaism and doing it from a Christian rather than from a Jewish perspective, with Christian hindsight. While this is not at all a novel interpretation, historically speaking, the regenerate viewpoint has been the favorite of Reformed Christians, and the unregenerate view the choice of Arminians. Thus, we'll attempt as well to clear the ground for a revival of the unregenerate view for Christians who take depravity with Calvinistic earnestness. Let's look at an analysis of these verses. There seems to be little doubt among commentators that when Paul uses the first person pronoun I in Romans 7, that he could be speaking of people in general, speaking as an everyman. Thus, he puts himself in the shoes of a non-Christian Jew in Romans 7, 7 through 14. You can keep up on that legal sized handout. There he distances himself from the idea that the law of God is itself sinful. Seeing that the law seems to arouse sin in us, is it therefore true that the law is sin? Quite the contrary. But while the proper function of the law is to identify what is sinful, the man in the flesh finds in that an opportunity for further rebellion. But it is sin that is the cause of death, not the law. Now Paul jumps from the aorist tense to the present tense in verse 14 with the statement, ego des sarkinos a me, but I am of flesh. The present tense continues through verse 25 where he says, I am serving the law of God. This could possibly signal a shift from pre-Christian to Christian, from I died under the law to yes, even as a Christian, I'm still having trouble obeying God. But the matter is hardly settled by a change of tenses. The time of the action can be determined not merely on the formal grounds of being a present tense. A reasonable alternative is that Paul is switching to a dramatic use of the historical present in order to underscore the painful and universal incongruity between wishing and doing. I wish this, but I do that. So we must therefore look into the context to find out the place of this in Paul's actual argument. Taken as a whole, Romans 7 is best viewed as a parenthetical development of Romans chapter 6. And as James Dunn points out, in Romans 6, Paul deals with the dichotomies of sin and grace, mentioning the law only in verses 14 and 15, and then in passing. He has put the issue of the law to one side until he can establish the meaning of union with Christ by grace alone. In the meantime, his Jewish readers might have been thinking, yes, it is true for the Gentiles that sin invariably leads to death. But for us, the law is the bridge from life to death because it promotes good deeds. For example, thy word have I treasured in my heart that I may not sin against thee, Psalm 119:11. Or man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord, Deuteronomy 8:3. In other words, that man lives by Torah, by the law of God. So Paul can now return to the issue of righteousness by the law with full force in chapter 7. And with the exception of verse 25, every statement in this chapter seems to have a negative purpose, mainly the demolition of this hope that a man can please God apart from grace alone. He uses the metaphor of marriage in 7:1 through 6, in order to prove that death severs the law's grip. He then demonstrates that life under the law is truly life in the flesh. Thus, in verses 5 and 6, he observes, for a while we were in the flesh. The sinful passions which were aroused by the law were at work in the members of our body to bear fruit for death. But now we have been released from the law, having died to that by which we were bound, so that we serve in newness of the spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. There are a number of plausible interpretations of verses 7 through 13. Underlying any interpretation, however, must be Paul's clear intention to reinforce the theme of verses 1 through 6 and to defend himself against the charges that he is calling the law of God an agent of sin. Why do the Jews sin? There is nothing wrong with the law. There is everything wrong with the hearer. The word of life makes me a sinner because that is what I am. When he begins verse 14 with the Greek word gar, for, in English, he is implying that there is a causal connection with the previous thought, namely, even a righteous commandment will lead to his death because indwelling sin rears its head. Why is this so, Paul? Here's the cause, that although the law is spiritual, I am enslaved to sin. And so in this context, verses 14 and following serve as justification for verses 7 through 13, illustrating that the power of internal sin can and does ruin my effort to please God through the law. Gaudet points out that if Paul in verse 14 is switching from the non-Christian to the Christian, he could hardly have been more understated. There is no mention of conversion, of Christ, or the Spirit in the section which follows. And in fact, the condition within sin, the law, and death remains the same as it does for the non-Christian in verse 5 and in verses 7 through 13. The real change of viewpoint comes rather, Gaudet says, in verse 1 of chapter 8, where the man in Christ now stands under no condemnation. But in verses 14 and following, Paul means to show three things. One, that no one can will himself to be righteous. Two, that the attempt to do so only ends in more sin, in frustration, and in death. And three, that the law is of no help and may, in fact, make things worse, as he said in 6:14 and 7:5 already. The picture of the wretched man is thus precisely what Paul could be expected to create. For while in reality, life under the law did not lead the Jews to despair, the Christian Paul perceives that it should do so. I'd like to take some time and examine the traits of the wretched man, which I believe is the unregenerate man, in 14 to 25, traits which are found elsewhere in Romans. The first trait is in verse 14, I am of flesh. Paul takes this to be a carnal Christian who is, on the one hand, a sinner, and on the other hand, declared righteous in God's eyes, to use his phrase, simul justus et peccator. But surely this is not the use of sarkinos, or of flesh, in this chapter. Rather, it seems to be synonymous with ente sarki, in the flesh, in verse 5, and also with life in the flesh, in Romans 8, 5 through 8. There, Paul uses flesh to describe life apart from Christ, rather than the life of the carnal Christian. The second characteristic is that I am sold into bondage to sin. Again, verse 14. Again, Christians may empathize with this phrase on one level, but in context, slavery means something far worse than having trouble with sin's power. Sin acting as king or as slave master over the non-Christian is an important motif for Romans chapter 6. And in Romans 6:6, he shows that dying to sin is a part of being in Christ, quote, that we should no longer be slaves to sin. In verse 11, even so consider yourselves to be dead to sin, but alive to God in Christ Jesus. And that sin's bondage is pre-conversion is shown by 6:20. For when you were slaves of sin, you were free in regard to righteousness. When Christians are told, do not let sin reign in verse 12, there is the implied possibility of voluntarily serving sin, but the fact remains that, having been freed from sin, you became servants of righteousness, 6:18. So when Paul says, I am of flesh, sold into bondage to sin, he is using language which he has just said applies to those outside of Christ. The third trait or characteristic, I delight in the law, and again, I joyfully concur with the law in the inner man, and I'm taking inner man there to be nothing more than a synonym to in my mind, in my thinking process. You see this in verse 14, verse 16, 22, 25, this inconsistency that he's delighting in the law but not actually doing it. These statements provide much of the impetus for the regenerate approach. How can it be affirmed in a pivotal passage that there is none who seeks for God, Romans 3:11, and at the same time say that unregenerate people can joyfully concur with the law of God in the inner man in 7:22. When Paul says that none seeks for God, what does he do with those who apparently are seeking for God apart from the cross? What about the pious Jew who seems to seek after righteousness? May we think of depravity's work in subtler tones? Perhaps that a person who supposes he wants to do the right thing is deceived if he thinks he is thereby pleasing God? In fact, what we find is that Paul's theology of the unregenerate life is sufficiently nuanced to admit this interpretation. The answer comes from within Romans, where Paul fine-tunes his doctrine of depravity. Paul himself observes that non-Christian Jews are seeking after righteousness by the law of Moses. The Jews rely upon the law and boast in God, and know his will, and approve the things that are essential, being instructed out of the law, Romans 2:17b and 18. The whole point of Romans 2 is the oft-repeated truth that not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law will be justified, Romans 2:13. Phrase or a theme you see in Jesus' teaching and also in James. Again, in Romans 9:31, he restates that Israel, pursuing a law of righteousness, did not arrive at that law. Did the Jews of Paul's day hear the law? Yes. Did they approve the law? Yes. Their motivations are mixed, of course, but they felt that they were approving of God's law. Did they delight in the law? Apparently so. Do they wish to do the law? Yes. But do they, in fact, do the law? No. Long before Romans 7, Paul has already devastated their case by showing that wishing to do and doing are separate acts. And it is only willing and doing together that God recognizes as righteousness. Now this points up a hermeneutical danger, that of reading Romans 3:11, there is none who seeks for God, and drawing immediate conclusions about Romans chapter 7. We must also work through Romans chapter 2, which hints at the matrix for this picture of the wretched man. Paul is there criticizing, in Romans 2, conventional Jewish confidence, based on the theory that everyone is born with both an inclination to evil, which the Jews call the Yetzer Hara, the evil impulse, and an inclination to good, the Yetzer HaTov, the good impulse. These two impulses were thought to strive for mastery in each man. Hearing and obeying the Torah would help to strengthen the good Yetzer, or the good impulse. Now, this optimistic view of victory over sin is exemplified by the rabbinical commentary or midrash on Psalm 41, verse 1. Blessed is he that considereth the poor. And the commentary, the word poor is taken to be a symbol for the good Yetzer. This is through midrashic interpretation. And thus the commentary reads, because not all people heed the inclination to good, blessed is that man who does heed it. And the commentary goes on to say that a man is able to deliver the inclination to good from the inclination to evil. The implication is that when you sin, you do so because you have neglected the good Yetzer, the good impulse. If you so will, you can, therefore, do God's law. And E.P. Sanders points out in Paul and Palestinian Judaism that one of the differences between Paul and Palestinian Jews was that Paul had a doctrine of original sin or depravity, and the Jews basically rested their view of depravity on this good Yetzer, evil Yetzer, which are wrestling inside each individual. Likewise, Hellenistic Judaism. The Hellenistic author of 4 Maccabees, perhaps a contemporary to Paul, crafts his own illustration of the 10th commandment. To quote, "For the law says, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or anything that is your neighbor's." It goes on to say, "Surely then, since the law tells us not to covet, I should the much more readily persuade you that reason has the power to control the desires." But Paul's own pessimistic view was that sin, taking opportunity through the 10th commandment, produced in me coveting of every kind, Romans 7, verse 8. Then when Paul quotes the scriptures in Romans 3:10 and following to prove that none seeks after God, he is arguing a point which was by no means self-evident to the Jews, that even their striving is tainted by sin. Thus, in Romans 7:14-25, Paul stands rabbinic theology completely on its head. For the man under the law, apart from Christ, the evil Yetzer always has the last word. And the desire to do the law, the mythical good Yetzer, the good impulse, is merely an impotent wishing that never comes to pass. And note especially verses 22 and 23. The fourth characteristic, for the good that I wish I do not do, 7:19. I'd like to consider Paul's use of the Greek verb thelo here, which is usually rendered to wish or to will, a verb which is used 7 times in this passage. It has the meaning to desire, to have, or to experience something. In the New Testament, it often denotes the resolute striving which characterizes the Jewish piety. But when used of Christians, thelo usually appears alongside words of doing working and acting, which should tell us something. This is best captured in Philippians 2:13. God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. In other words, God working creates both the desire for good and the ability to do good. But the word thello, to wish, alone says nothing about the ability of the person to act in this passage. And in fact, Romans 7:14 to 25 speaks of one who invariably fails to act. We can therefore render the verb to wish in this passage little more than a daydream. And this is reinforced in Romans 8:7, where we are told that inability reigns whatever one's wishes. The mind set on the flesh is hostile towards God, for it does not subject itself to the law of God, for it is not even able to do so. Speaking of action. Fifth characteristic, no mention of the Holy Spirit. This fact is heavily emphasized by some commentators, and while it is an argument from silence, the context seems to make the omission meaningful. For Romans 8:2, it is said that the justified one has been set free from the law of sin and death by the law of the Spirit of life. It is by the Spirit that Christians please God and begin putting to death the deeds of the body, Romans 8:13. The sixth characteristic or sixth trait is this cry in verse 24, "Wretched man that I am." Again, Romans 8:6 speaks of the life and peace that belong to the Christian. While the Christian life is always a struggle, see especially Philippians 3:12 to 14, at the same time, it is not a life of total despair. It is true that non-Christians do not always exhibit despair, in fact, rarely do, but with his enlightened eyes, Paul asserts that not only should Jews not boast, they should actually despair of ever pleasing God. But that is his conclusion as a Christian, not as a Jew himself. Seventh characteristic, nothing good dwells in me, Romans 7:18. Just briefly, this can be said of an unbeliever, but not of the believer, except as an overstatement. Number eight, I practice the very evil that I do not wish, Romans 7:19. The plain interpretation of 7:19 and really the whole tenor of the section is that the wretched man consistently lives in sin and is always frustrated when he wishes to do better. It's an amazing piece of irony that one Bible commentator after another will look at this passage and call it a description of an inconsistent life. Thus, Leon Morris says, "For surely this is the experience of the believer. No believer is completely sinless." He goes on to say that what he does is never completely what he wants to do. Luther understands Paul as trying to say that he does not do the good as often and as much and with as much ease as he would like. Calvin said that the faithful never reach the goal of righteousness as long as they dwell in the flesh. Hendrickson concludes that the situation pictured in 7:14-25 is not all dark. I'd like to suggest that in all these cases, the interpreter is forced to reject a literal interpretation of verses 14 to 25. In watering down Paul's description, they take it to be a gross exaggeration of the struggle of the Christian life. Taken at face value, Romans 7 does not say sin will not always be defeated, or that it's as if I cannot do the good. It suggests that sin is never defeated. At this point, the early Augustine makes a helpful suggestion, which unfortunately he later retracted. The Pelagians wanted to say that regeneration was not a necessary experience in order to work righteousness. Augustine pointed out that the futile operation of the will in Romans 7, in fact, disproves the Pelagians by showing that the will never works good. John Wesley does the same thing, by the way. It was Augustine in his Confessions that applied Romans 7:17 to his own frustration at serving God before his conversion. It was I who willed to take this course, and again, it was I who willed not to take it. It was I and I alone. At its very best, the will of the unregenerate may be free to dream, but not to effect righteousness. And as Paul makes so clear in Romans 2, it is not good intentions, but good works that God approves. Thus, we could say that the wretched man of Romans 7 does not lead an inconsistent life. Yes, there is a discrepancy between the impotent wishing and the sinful action, but the record of his life is entirely consistent. Apart from Christ, he is not able not to sin. The Christian's life is never that constant. He is able to sin. He is also able not to sin. In fact, later on, Paul maintains that Christians are able to obey the law when they love each other and thus fulfill the entire law in Romans 13, 8-10. The Christian life is difficult, Paul points out, and bound to be inconsistent, but it is not impossible for the one with the Spirit of God. In verses 24 and 25, Paul poses a cry of hopelessness. Who will set me free from the body of this death? One might guess that this question should have been left rhetorical and not answered by Paul. But I would surmise that Paul is viewing this tragedy from a Christian outlook. He's putting himself in the place of an unsaved person who regards himself as a wretched man, and he sees this wretchedness from a Christian perspective. And in that sense, because he's viewing this tragedy from a Christian outlook, he jumps ahead of himself and answers the rhetorical question anyway, anticipating the birth, which he'll describe in verses 1 and 2 of the next chapter, the answer that God, through Jesus Christ, will rescue me. The section is then properly finished in verse 25, where Paul recapitulates a little bit. And from the perspective of either camp, whether this is a regenerate man or an unregenerate, the ending is a little bit anticlimactic because Paul jumped ahead prematurely to the right answer. But that doesn't pose any particular problems to either viewpoint. But the point of the section has been made. For the unregenerate man, the role of the law is in fact to prove the futility of pursuing righteousness by works. That life closed off from Christ leads only to a cycle of defeat and reinforces the point of Romans 6:23. At this point, I'd like to just say a few words about three usual objections to the unregenerate man interpretation. The first objection I'd like to discuss, the main one, is that this stands contrary to the Reformed doctrine of total depravity. With respect to our approach, the Reformed commentator William Hendrickson stated that it is in favor with Pelagians and to a certain extent with Arminians. However, even some Reformed writers have endorsed the position. But despite his lurking bias, which I would say is equal and opposite to Leinhardt's, the problem is a real one. Can one hold to total depravity and still grant to the unregenerate person the capabilities expressed in Romans chapter 7? We can do so if we follow the line of reasoning developed so far, that the wish to do the law is relative, that it moves the unregenerate not a bit closer to the divine standard, and that it is tainted through and through by depravity. Among systematicians, we find the regenerate man in Romans 7, or among systematicians who find the regenerate man in Romans 7, we might even detect a trace of inconsistency on this point. For example, Burkhoff relates Romans 7 to Paul as a Christian, one of the subsets to the regenerate viewpoint, autobiographical, and he says that this is a text which is parallel to Philippians 3, 12-14. But elsewhere in his excellent description of depravity and inability in his systematic theology, he states, negatively, depravity does not imply, one, that every man is as thoroughly depraved as he possibly can become, two, that the sinner has no innate knowledge of the will of God, nor a conscience that discriminates between good and evil, three, that sinful man does not often admire virtuous character and action in others. When we speak of man's corruption as total inability, we mean two things. One, that the unrenewed sinner cannot do any act, however insignificant, which fundamentally meets with God's approval, his emphasis, and answers to the demands of God's holy law. And two, that he cannot change his fundamental preference for sin and self to love for God, nor even make an approach to such a change. In a word, he is unable to do any spiritual good. In his commentary on Romans, Charles Hodge promotes the regenerate view for the ordinary reasons, but in his theology, he makes this point about depraved people or depraved man. He retains his reason, will, and conscience. He has the intellectual power of cognition, the power of self-determination, and the faculty of discerning between moral good and evil. His conscience, as the apostle says, approves or disapproves of his moral acts. Well, this is precisely what may be discerned in Romans chapter 7. The will there is torn between the corrupted remnants of conscience and the greater power of indwelling sin, so that even the wish for good is crushed, or to quote Burkhoff, he cannot do. The will, for many reasons, is incapable of pleasing God, The actions consistently displease God, and there is nothing in this viewpoint, according to these systematicians, which is necessarily Arminian. Second objection is that this viewpoint does not take into account a parallel passage in Galatians 5:17. If you have a New Testament, you may want to take a glance at that. Galatians 5:17 states, "For the flesh sets its desires against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. For these are in opposition to one another, so that you may not do the things that you please." The two passages, admittedly, sound alike, but the contrasts are even more telling. In Romans 7, the war is between ineffective moral desires and indwelling sin. In Galatians 5, the powerful Holy Spirit and indwelling sin are at battle. That this is speaking of the same battle is contradicted by what proceeds in Galatians, where Christians are told, "Walk by the Spirit, and you will not carry out desires of the flesh." Galatians 5 is filled with the possibility of walking in righteousness. For example, "For you were called to freedom, brethren, only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh." 13. "If you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law." 18. Contrast Romans 7, where he is under the law. "If we live by the Spirit, let us also walk by the Spirit." Verse 25. A third objection, the final one, is that if we take this to be the unregenerate man, then this gives a triumphalistic picture of the Christian life as always succeeding, and it takes away some of the realistic description of the real struggle that Christians face. We would reply that the Christian life is indeed a struggle, and that Paul describes the ferocity of that struggle in Romans 6, in Romans 8, in Romans 12, in Philippians 3, Galatians 5, but not in Romans 7. When we take a passage of utter and complete defeat and say that this is not the Christian life, it is not thereby proof that holiness is always victorious. It simply means that holiness is sometimes victorious. In conclusion, Paul is not here trying to balance his teaching about being dead to sin in Romans 6 and 8. Rather, in Romans 7, he is showing one final time that it is impossible to obey God through good intentions about doing the law. The Jews and the Judaizers both may have lauded the grace of God, even as they rejected salvation by God's grace alone. This does not mean that we can confine them to a doctrine of justification by works alone. A gospel of works is not the sole enemy of sola gratia, by grace alone. Grace is also diminished in a theory of salvation by means of, with the aid of, or on the basis of anything that is not divine grace. Paul's point comes clear. You are saved by God's grace. Thus, any attempt to earn God's favor by works is unproductive and is positively a fall from grace, to take the true sense of Galatians 5:4. For Paul, it must follow that Christ is the end of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone who is believing. Romans 10:4. Got a couple of practical things I put at the end. One difference between a sermon and an academic talk is that in an academic talk, you cut out all the practical stuff and just leave the theoretical stuff. First practical idea is that I mentioned the preaching of Romans chapter 7 as being a description of the struggle of the Christian life, and I'm suggesting that that's not primarily what Romans 7 is all about. I preached through Romans 7 last year and spent a great deal of time thinking about how to preach on this, taking the viewpoint that I do. And so when I read the passage, I began the sermon by saying, we've all had days like this, but that I went on to say that this is an entire life like this, a life of entire defeat. And part of the application was that if your life is complete defeat, as is the man's in Romans 7, then don't blame the incompletion of your sanctification. This is not God's fault. He's given you enough equipment to live holiness, although inconsistently. I then went on to point out that Paul had very little patience for Christians who claimed that they were unable to do God's will. A second practical consideration is about evangelistic technique. And this I haven't really actually put into practice, but I'm just kicking this around. If this is truly about an unsaved person, could we use this passage in evangelism? To give an example, year after year on January 1st, people resolve to do better. They resolve to quit smoking, to lose weight, to get in shape, to be kinder to everybody this year. And year after year, almost invariably, they fail. Perhaps in evangelism we could affirm that people have good intentions, but also point out that the unsaved could emotionally empathize with a wretched man here. Could we then draw them to the logical conclusion, which Paul brings out in Romans 7, that in the closed system of their lives, things will not improve? That if things haven't gotten better so far, then they will never get better. And in fact, that in the end, they'll always wind up in defeat, and in no way are they pleasing to God. This is one of the vital roles of the law, according to Reformed doctrine, to strip people of false hope and to make them admit their need of external help in a Savior. So perhaps in evangelistic thinking, this is one possibility of applying this. We have there's some time for discussion before we break up. Any questions?
You are people, however, who are not Christians, who do influence their lifestyle. You do keep resolutions to you in the position. You do worry about stopping and drinking and losing weight, etc. And how much does that argue against the impact of the evangelism?
I think what happens there is that I think Paul deals with that. I'm not sure how that would work out practically. But Paul is speaking to Jews who are quite optimistic about their chances with holiness and before God as judge. And by showing them that their state is wretched, he's showing them something new that they didn't understand. They'd never reached that conclusion. I don't think Paul, before he became a Christian on the Damascus Road, was frustrated either. I think he was pretty confident about how he was doing. So in a sense, Paul is looking back from a Christian vantage point and saying, I never knew this, but I wasn't getting anywhere with God. Now, if you can impress that on people in evangelism, that may help. But I'm not sure if that's self-evident to them, to the minority that feel that they're self-improving.
No, maybe have to get to the point to do look back. Paul didn't.
Yeah. And even if you quit smoking, I mean, where does that take you as far as God's standard of holiness anyway, so which he brings out in another section of Romans. In reading through Romans lately, Romans 3.23 was the first Bible verse I memorized. I got saved from it, okay? And I've always thought that Romans 3.23 was the most self-evident verse of the New Testament. All has sinned and fall short of the glory of God. I'm coming to the conclusion lately that for Paul's Jewish readers, that all have sinned was self-evident. They fall short of God's glory was a complete shock to them. That the first half was fine, the second half was a complete revelation. And that's really what gives the end of Romans 23 its zing there. Mainly I'm promoting the view of the unregenerate man, but I think that that's a subcategory which I would deal with the most. Mainly because I don't think Paul's looking at the Jewish life in Jewish eyes, from Jewish perspective. I think he's looking at it from a Christian hindsight, and showing the Jews what they should be despairing about, but which they weren't despairing about. So I think that's a subcategory which I think of. And even though, I mean, you can get maybe some applications for number 5 there, that you can apply that to a Gentile moralist. I think that's true, but I don't think he's addressing Gentiles. If you take this completely literally, that Romans 7 points you to despair, I think it would lead to a lot of Christian despair, but I don't think people in the regenerate view take that completely literally, using literally broadly here. I think they have to take that as a hyperbole, that it's as if we can never do the thing we want. But Paul says pretty blandly, I do not do the thing I want. It doesn't seem to allow any exception. So I think Reformed Christians must allow exceptions when they're reading this and saying, well, that's hyperbole. It's Paul getting upset about it, but it's not absolutely literally true. Yeah, that if you take that out of the context of those very bold statements of Romans 6 about sin's mastery broken, I mean, we still are ruled by sin, but to the extent more or less that we are allowing it, and even within that, we may be addicted to sin. It may be out of control, out of our own control. It's awful hard to make a blanket generalization, and I've heard so many good sermons on this from a regenerate viewpoint, where I felt that the right application was drawn, that it's a hard life, but victory can be had. But to point to this as an excuse, I think even if Paul is taking a regenerate viewpoint, I think Paul would have been scandalized for someone to point to this and say, well, you know, I'm defeated before I try, so why bother forging ahead? Because Paul says, no, you know, I'm constantly reaching forward to the goal. And the thing for which I was laid hold of in Philippians 3. That seems to me to be the epitome of his spiritual attitude, or attitude toward growth. But, you know, if Christians take that as an excuse, it's wrong, but I don't think you have to, as long as you're taking it as hyperbole.
Let me ask a question. Paul says that he was 7 through 13.
No, I didn't say a whole lot about 7 through 13, frankly, because I find that a whole lot harder than the other one, which blows my mind even to think of that, because this is so difficult. I think 7 through 13, Paul is speaking the same way he is in 14 to 25, more or less as a Jewish everyman. I don't think he's speaking of his own bar mitzvah, which some have suggested. You know, I grew up, I was old enough, then the law came in, and I became a sinner. I think he's just thinking logically there. But if you're apart from the law, things look pretty good. But with the law, in a sense, makes you a sinner, makes you a transgressor. So I think there he's just speaking generically of life under Judaism, not necessarily autobiographically. So the same as he's speaking. Well, there, some would suggest, in the past, sin entered in, I became a transgressor, and so forth. Someone suggested that's Paul's past experience, but now present tense, this must be Paul's present experience. I think he's just switching to the present tense because it's a more dramatic way of speaking. It really brings out the vividness of this life where you're boxed in and you cannot break out on your own power. So I don't think he's switching tenses in order to necessarily make any more point than just to be emphatic. Just underscoring it a bit more. 7 through 13 is kind of a... I take that to be the unregenerate Jew as well, but there are so many variations on that theme, I didn't want to get into it too much. Seems like everybody takes a different viewpoint. Yeah, I take Philippians 3 to be Paul's autobiographical of what he felt as a Jew, and Romans 7 to be Paul looking back and saying, in retrospect, I was a sinner, but I didn't see that then. And Philippians 3, as far as we can tell from Philippians 3, Paul had no idea that he was going to lose it with God, you know, not have holiness. And even in his persecution of the Christians, I think Paul just viewed that as more merit than persecuting the heretics. He was standing in the line of the zealots, you know, Phineas and the Maccabees and so forth. So I think he even viewed that as a positive thing. So my viewpoint is that this is in no way autobiographical. When Paul met Christ on the Damascus Road, he couldn't have been more surprised that he was a sinner, that Christ was the Lord. All set?